And, yes, one more note here. During the last couple of weeks, we have been keeping you abreast of what has been happening in the varmint world. And we have a great varmint story tonight. I mean, it is a varmint story to end all varmint stories. Would you bring me some dramatic music on again? Once again, hit it hard. The big dramatic music. This is the kind of stuff you're always afraid of when you're camping. Virginia, Minnesota. Due to circumstances beyond his control, William Bradshaw will not be getting married this Sunday. All right, I'm going to read this article just the way it is. Listen, it says, you see, he explained he was taking a stroll through the woods, William Bradshaw, when he happened to see this dark-eyed female standing in his path. Like any honorable bridegroom-to-be, Bradshaw climbed a tree. Like any sylvan nymph, she followed. The first time, she pulled my boot off, Bradshaw exclaimed. The second time, she pulled my sock off. The third time, and there modesty overcame him. I reached over and grabbed another tree, he said. What did she pull off that time, I ask you? Bradshaw, a 23-year-old federal forest ranger, told his tale from the Virginia woods, from his hospital bed, where he was recovering from an unexpected encounter with an angry female bear. He said that he and two other rangers were walking through the woods Monday afternoon when he encountered the bear. She was looking at me from about 20 feet and acting skittish, he said. She wouldn't scare or anything. We hollered at her and just kept looking at me. And she got a little skittish. Then up the tree he went, with the bear close behind. When he switched trees, the bear followed him. She chewed at his foot and ankle a couple of times, and about the fifth time, she fell out of the tree, he said. By that time, I stopped yelling and shouting. He said, when he stopped yelling, he heard rustling in the brush, which I assume was a cub that she was probably protecting. Bradshaw said the whole thing lasted about a half an hour, but he stayed in the tree two more hours to make sure she wasn't hanging around. I came down and I crawled about a half a mile till I got to a high rock point about a quarter mile from the road, he said. By this time, his companion had begun yelling to him, and he hollered back. They picked him up, and now he's got a new set of jockey shorts. What a scene. I mean, you know, and you know, you always hear about bears as though, you know, oh, they're nothing. Just don't worry about the bear, you know, just it's like, shoot, 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 you know, scat, scat, scat. Well, let me tell you a little incident that I had about a bear. Now, I'll tell you, I was up in the Maine woods. I was camping. You got it? And everything's cool. I'm next to this lake. And I'm lying there in the sack. When all of a sudden, it was about, oh, must have been about 4:45, maybe 5:10, maybe something like that. But, well, I'd say around about 5 in the morning, just when the light was beginning to filter down through the heavy, thick green trees, I'm asleep. When all of a sudden, right next to my ear, I hear... Oh, shit. I mean, you know, this is a little piece of canvas. I mean, obviously, it was not anybody's friendly Pekingese, you know. This was not the friendly old Cocker Spaniel. He let out a snort, I'll tell you. What a snort. You ever heard a bear snort? Well, you may have heard one in the zoo once, but it's a little different when he's snorting next to your ear and you've got about a tenth of an inch of canvas between your ear and his snorter, you know. And he let out the snort. Well, I got up and I peered and I see this gigantic black thing. I saw this big black shape. It's like, well, he's gone. It's just gone. Well, what am I going to do? So the sun slowly came up and there it was. Sun's up. Oh, boy, does it look good. You know, the trees look so innocent. And I go out and here's the guy that runs the camera. I says, hey, there's a bear here last night. He says, nah, no bears here. There's no bears here. How would they? No bears, no bears. I said, well, look at the tracks down there. Look at big tracks. There's a track, you know, it's about the size of a pie plate, you know, with the great big nails on the front, you know, big holes in the ground. I said, look at the tracks there. By cracky. Huh. Well, first time I saw a bear here. I said, but there's a bear right there. He's going, you know, he was thinking of moving in my tent. I wonder what kind of bear it was. Using his main talk. Wonder what kind of bear it was. I said, well, I don't know what kind of a bear it was, but look at the size of them feet. Never saw a bear here. I guess that weren't a bear. I guess nobody believes it's a bear until you get your jockey shorts pulled right off. Is that it? I mean, you know, well these little moments, I think the fight against, the constant fight against the vermin world is one that we've all felt. And I remember one time when I was a kid, oh boy, I'll tell you, we had a swamp. Now, most, I would say this, one of the great educational experiences in life is to live near a swamp. You know, there's a lot of different kinds of people in their environment. You know, we never talk about what the natural environment does to man. We never discuss that. Whenever the word environment is used in classroom study, it almost always refers to the other kind of people you live with, the jobs they have, the economic condition. And so somebody will say, yes, but what were the environmental forces that worked on Fred? And they'll say, well, of course, his mother was a tall, nervous woman, and his father was kind of a quiet guy. They had medium income. Yeah, but the next question is, what kind of a sky did Fred grow up under? I mean, what was the sky like? What was the ground like where he lived? I mean, you can have a nervous mother and a nice, friendly father, but if you live on the edge of a quicksand lake and out of the sky every 15 minutes, on the hour, every hour, comes a tornado, you're going to have a different view of existence. But I have never yet heard a psychologist ask a kid or a patient what kind of natural environment he comes from. And so I submit to you that if you're living in the middle of the dark woods somewhere, and you're growing up and you're living next to a gravel road, and out there in the dark woods, from time to time can be heard, ooh, ow, 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 wow, wow. Then silence. The sound of the great northern screech owl, and you can hear the sound of the slow, eternal lapping of the lake. I don't care how nervous your mother is. I don't care how quiet and humble your father is. This has got to do something to you. Now, it can do something good or bad. You see, the assumption you're making out there, it must make you scared or something. No, I think it does quite the opposite. I think that once you've lived next to a lake of quicksand, and that you've heard the sound of the great northern screech owl howling at the moon, and you've heard the occasional skulking scratch of an unnamed varmint going through the bushes 20 feet away, it's a different man you are. You can't help it. And I wonder if many psychologists are taking this into effect. Or do they assume that the total acting environment on a person is the human people he lives with? Well, I think it's more complex than that. I think that we're a creature of nature just as much as the bear, just as much as the giraffe. And since we are a creature of nature, we're affected by not only the other creatures we're with, we're affected also by the world that we live in, the sand, the ground. And some people grow up next to the seashore, and I submit they're very different. I submit that a guy who has grown up living in Portland, Maine, has a different attitude towards the world than a guy who has lived outside of Olathe, Kansas, all of his life. Not because of... And I'm saying, granted, they have the same parents, same type of parents. I'm saying they're going to be different because of what's around them. And I'll never forget. I remember one time, the first time that I began to be a little bit aware of this, you know. You have to become aware of it if you travel much, and if you travel much geographically. Most people don't really travel much. They go from one city to the next. That's called traveling. They leave New York and go to Paris. Well, you know, this is the same environment. It's a city. Or they'll leave Paris and they'll go to Rome. This is a city. I don't know whether many people have actually spent a week, say, living near Olathe, Kansas. Get the feel of this scene, you know. It's very different. You learn a little bit about the world. You learn a little bit about how people are and how they act and what makes them act that way. But the first time I began to be aware of this was when I was a kid, and I was just in the Army. I was about 17, and I had never really traveled much. My idea of a real big trip, you know, was go to Indianapolis. If I were really going to take a fantastic trip, was go off to Michigan. And that was it. Never had been to the East Coast. Never been to the West Coast. I lived all my life right there, you know, northern Indiana, around Chicago scene. I assumed that was the way the world was. You know, you just don't really question these things much. And suddenly, boom, pow, I'm in the Army. Well, luckily enough, or unluckily, I don't know, I'm sent to a camp that was not maybe 25, 50 miles away, you know, for induction, where they put you in the suit, see. So next thing I know, I'm up in Camp Fort Sheridan, see, and they put my suit on me. Well, this is Chicago. And I'm looking out, oh, boy, where am I going to go? Excitement, where are you going to go? You don't know, have no idea which direction you're going to go. You can go any place. They can send you to Texas, they can send you to Alaska, they can send you to train, you know, they can send you to California, and who knows where you're going to go. Well, they put me in a train, along with about 200 other guys, and I'm sharing a seat with this guy. And these characters had been sent from all over the country to be inducted into the Army. Some of them came from the East, some of them came from Texas, you know, they just sent them all. It's a big induction center, see, so here's this guy. How he ever wound up there, I don't know, but he's sitting in the seat next to me. And the train starts. We had no idea where we were going. We were not told where we were going. And it was a secret troop movement. And we took off. It was about, maybe 6 o'clock in the evening. It was just about supper time, I remember. And we rolled into the Chicago station. We took off from Fort Sheridan. We rolled into Chicago. And the train stopped. And have you ever been in a big station with a lot of troops, start wandering around, and you see some trainees come in, a lot of guys are sitting there with their barracks bags and all that? Well, that's what happened to us, see. We're all sitting around with our barracks bags, about 5,000 of us waiting, just sitting in the... And the civilians were walking around looking at us. Gee, look at those poor guys. They're going in the Army, holy smokes. And the Red Cross girls were coming around. They were giving us donuts and the whole bit. Here I am sitting in my own hometown. All of a sudden, I'm a foreigner, see. I couldn't get out. They wouldn't let you even go beyond. They wouldn't let you call. They wouldn't let you do anything. So we just sat there, see. Well, it was about 9 o'clock, and they finally packed us all in this train, and we took off. It was dark, you know. Remember this, dark. And we started to roll out through the night. We rolled out through Indiana, all the way through down south. We rolled through the southern part of Indiana, we're rolling, see. And this guy is sitting next to me, and I remember his name. His name was Dan. I wonder if he's listening tonight. He could be listening tonight, because the point of the story is, you'll find out why I say this when we get to the point of the story. And so this guy, Dan, sitting next to me, Dan, he knew a couple of other guys in the car, and they're hollering back and forth. And I didn't know him. He didn't know me, but we were both 17 or 18, both going in the Army. And we're looking out of the window, and it's black. The train, it's night. It's black and hot and uncomfortable. Our clothing scratched us, and we were sweating. It was not a sleeper, by the way. We were supposed to sleep right sitting up in our seat there, wherever we were going. We were going to sit up in the seat and sleep. It was going to be all night. And it was going to be part of the next day, and far into the night. So we're rolling along. And the train is clipping. Boy, I'll tell you, this was a fast train. It wasn't one of those trains where, you know, every 20 minutes the troop train pulls off to the side. We were just clipping through the night. And all of a sudden, I looked down, and we're going over a bridge. And he looked out. We're both looking down. And I can remember the sight. It's like, You know, I think all of us have about 25 sites that are engraved in our mind absolutely indelibly. We'll never forget them. And this is one of mine. Absolutely. I'm not inventing. This is absolutely stuck right there in my mind. And I looked out of the bridge, and I could see down below me a river. And this river was just floating along, and it was way down below, and you could see the moon, beautiful moon, rippling off the river. And I saw a snag, a log, floating along on that river, and the two dark banks, widespread. And we're going across this river on a bridge, a high bridge, a railroad bridge. We're looking down, and he's looking down, and I'm looking down. And we had no idea where we were. And up ahead, the first lieutenant was sitting. He was about three or four seats ahead, and I got up a little guts in those days. I didn't know what an officer was yet. He was kind of like daddy or something, see. And I saw him up, and I said, "Lieutenant," I said, "do you know what river that is down there?" He looked down. He says, "Yes." He said, "I think that's the Ohio." And we were crossing the Ohio River. I'd never heard, you know, I'd heard of the Ohio, of course, but I'd never seen it or crossed it or anything. And there it was. It was like one of those great things that all of your life you hear of. Like most people hear of the Montana Mountains. They'll hear of the Grand Tetons. Most people will have heard of Crater Lake. Most people have heard of the Missouri, the Big Muddy. Most people have heard of the Missouri or the Mississippi or the Snake River. You've heard of the Rio Grande. And yet, you don't put these things into specifics. They're just a thing you heard of. You saw it on a map. You flew over it once on an airplane. But there below us with a snag floating along in the moonlight was the Ohio. And we were heading south. And Dan looks at me and says, "I wonder where we're going." I said, "I don't know." And then the train plunged into darkness again. And it was now about 11 o'clock, and they turned out all the lights in the troop train. We were traveling in the dark. We were so excited, we couldn't sleep. You know, boy, were we excited. And it was getting darker and darker now. As we get into areas where the towns are smaller and smaller and smaller. And then we suddenly got to a place. It must have been about 4 o'clock in the morning. This train is clipping along at about 500 miles an hour. It's about 4 o'clock in the morning, no lights at all. Once in a great while, you'd see off in the distance a solitary street light. Not even a street, just a light. Just a light. And we're roaring through the night. And I notice this guy next to me is getting nervous. He really is getting, he's getting nervous. Very, 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 very jumpy. And I began to suspect that he was afraid of going in the army and all that, you know. And we got talking in the dark. We're just having one of these kind of strangers who have been thrown together conversation, like, "I don't know, gee, how long you been in the army?" I said, "Well, I just got in 4 days ago." "How long you been in?" "I got in a week ago. I've been shipping." "Where'd you ship in from?" "I was inducted in New York." "New York?" I said, "Yeah, from New York." "It's New York." Then he says, "You talk funny." I says, "I talk funny?" He says, "Yeah, you know, you don't talk like the guys from New York." I said, "Well, you talk funny." He says, "Yeah?" I says, "Yeah." We're rolling through that blackness. Boy, was it dark. It was so dark you couldn't even see your hand. And I could hear other guys talking in the darkness around us. And we're roaring on. You could smell these new uniforms. And you could smell the train. You could smell the oil and the grease. Once in a while, way up ahead, the train would go, ooh, when we go roaring through a crossing somewhere. And we would pass a crossing. I recall that. It's about all we ever saw. It seemed like about every half hour, you'd hear this ding, 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 ding. It would go past you. The sound of a crossing gate. Whoop. He'd blow that horn. Well, then it slowly began to get light. You know how it does. And this was early in spring. Our induction had happened. It was still cold out. sort of half cold and half spring and half warm. And it began to slowly get light. And Dan was drowsing off next to me. And I'm sort of half drowsing. My head is up against the window. And I'm looking out. I remember I was sitting next to the window. He was sitting on the aisle seat. And we're both drowsing down. By this time, we're really pooed out. It's about 5 o'clock in the morning. We're sweating and our whiskers are growing out. We're feeling grubby and cruddy. We've been on the train now since 6 o'clock the night before. And we haven't even walked around. We're all tired. And all our equipment is hanging above our heads. They had racks where we could hang our gas masks and our helmets and our canteens, and all the junk is hanging above our head and banging back and forth. I wake up, and at first I didn't know where I was. It was funny. You know, that feeling of disorientation. And I woke up and I was not even used to being in the Army. I was still used to being at home, you know, being a kid and all that stuff. And I woke up and all of a sudden, Jack, I could smell, funny smell. I woke up and I could hear this rattling and banging. I looked around and this stuff, I said, didn't go away. this strange dream, and this, I see the pack swinging over my head, and I could smell the waterproofing in it and all that, you know, and I could smell the dubbing. And then I look, and here's Dan next to me, and he's sound asleep, and he's got his head on my shoulder. And he's sound asleep, and he's got his hat pulled down, his collar ripped open, he's snoring away. And it's now about 5:20, something like that. And we're slowly beginning to come to life. The guy's waking up. And I'm looking out. And there it is out there. As far as the eye can see. There it is, stretching out endlessly. Mile after mile after mile after mile after mile after mile after uncounted, fantastically unmentionable, unnumberable miles. Laying out there, as far as the eye could see, just laying out there, with the sun just beginning to show white and gray, vaguely warmish, springish, coldish, out over that great vast world. It was the Great Plains. The Great Plains. Endlessly, mile after mile, way off in the distance, out against the horizon, you could see a thin line of telegraph poles, like thin silhouetted toothpicks. It was so far away you couldn't even see the wire. It was just mile after mile of flat horizon, just laying there. And the sun was hanging up and casting a cold, gray, bluish, whitish, yellowish light. And next to me is Dan, half asleep. And over us, the canteen swung back and forth. And all of a sudden, Dan woke up. He looked around, and you could see he was going through the same scene that I was going through, that disorientation. Hey, what's going on? Hey. And then he looked out of the window. And believe me, if you've ever seen the guy's face get white with terror, it was just drained. No color at all. He was white. He said, where are we? What is that? What's all that out there? You know, it didn't surprise me. I've been out there for all my life, really, you know. I said, what do you mean? He says, where are we? Where is that out there? I says, the plains. He says, the what? I says, the plains, Dad. And he began to show all the evident and the outward signs of borderline hysteria. Here was this guy from the Sheepshead Bay district of Brooklyn, all of a sudden, for the first time in his life, looking out on the Great Plains, and it scared the daylights out of him. was where we were going. We were heading to the plains, and we were in the plains. And I recall Dan taking the upper bunk above me that night, our first night in camp. And he was turning and tossing. I could hear him above me. And he would look down once in a while. I would see his face hanging down from the bunk. He'd say, "Hey, Shep, are you still there?" I'd say, "Yes, Dan. What's the matter?" He said, "This is spooky. There's nothing but fields out here. There ain't no roads, nothing. There's no streetlights, nothing out here. There ain't even no subway." I says, "Dan, there's nothing. Nothing." And that first night, somewhere in the darkness, way off in the foothills of the Ozark, Dan heard his first owl hooting in the high woods that ran trickling down to the edge of the plains where our camp was nestled. And it was there that I knew forever and ever that man can never escape the ground that he lives in. Never. And forever, no matter where Dan was sent, to the sands of the Sahara, where he eventually wound up, there was a rattling B train. There was a double A that continually pulled into 23rd Street, always eternally. And if you've ever lived on the Great Plains, you'll never get those waving, long fields of endless plains grass out of your gut. It's always there, and you'll never change. If you grew up living next to Portland, the light, looking out to sea, you'll never get the smell of the salt out of your soul ever. You'll never get away from the sound deep down inside your gut of the long sea as it comes roaring in with a nor'easter tailing it. Boom. There's no changing it. And so someday, when the psychologists finally evolved their science, they will ask you, what kind of moon grew and swung high over the hills as your quiet little father hid under the table and your mother threw pots at him? Good night.